it's all well and good having these great schemes around closing the gap and all these ambitious, tokenistic, I guess, programs. The grassroots level of it is that we're not doing enough. There's more Aboriginal children in out-of-home care than there was during the stolen generations. And so sort of I pretty much put on them and said, what are you really going to do to improve it? What are your actions? It was awesome. It was an awesome feeling. I think you can sort of tell when someone speaks with passion and speaks with honesty and sincerity.
We tell stories to share the human experience.
No matter what form it takes.
Actor, photographer, theatre maker, musician, whoever is trying to be heard.
We can't stop telling stories. There's no end to them.
By telling stories, we connect to each other and create a sense of community.
This is an opportunity to share stories from a talented and diverse range of individuals, in the hope it provides inspiration and knowledge.
This is a podcast about Australian storytelling in all its forms, hosted by two Australians in the arts industry.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling. Hi, everybody.
I'm Nick Kane.
And I'm Lauren Bailey.
And thanks for listening.
And welcome to Podcast 24.
Yes, and first of all, we would like to show our respect and acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, of elders past and present, on which this podcast recording today takes place.
And we would also like to acknowledge that Nick has a cold.
too. And, this is that deep voice. You're like, wow, there's a new guest.
Oh, is Lauren doing the interview with Nick's relative?
Barry White. Yes. Yes, you are. Yes. Hello, I'm Barry White.
And also just a quick reminder to everyone about our social media platforms. Just a reminder, if you're enjoying the podcast or if this is your first podcast and you get to the end and you have enjoyed it, you can like us on Facebook.
Yes.
You can follow us on
Twitter.
What else can you do? Oh, you could give us 5 stars or as many stars as you like on iTunes.
That would be great.
And of course, we have our website and our About Me page. And we'll list these again at the end. And we're everywhere, really. But just thought it was good to
let you know.
Moving right along.
Yeah, let's move right along. Let's get straight into it. We've got a very exciting podcast for you today. But first of all, Lauren, I want to hear about your month. How's it been? Sorry, my voice will randomly break.
A little bit
this.
Of falsetto there. Yeah. Right, okay. I've had a great month. Let me tell you why. I was editing the bookends for last month's podcast and realised that once again I was editing myself, telling you about how at one point or another in time I had burnt myself out and how I really had to do something about that going
it's
forward.
It's a recurrent theme, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I actually am a bit scared. I thought, oh, I should go back and listen to previous podcasts and figure out how often I've said this. And then I decided I had better things to do with my time. But it did make me really aware that I wanted to be able to record this month and have that not be the case.
Okay.
And to do that, things, you know, something needs to shift, obviously. Yes. Mm-hmm. So I made a few decisions, and one of them was that I decided to work at living proactively rather than reactively.
Okay.
And this is one of the things that I feel causes this burnout. I get so busy that I start just responding to things and then trying to complete tasks to the best of my ability for whatever the next deadline is in order of priority. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, right, I'm going to take control of things.
Okay. And how do you do that necessarily? Like, is there a couple of steps?
Yeah.
Drilling
just,
right
just
into
feed
it?
Feed me the questions.
There you go, segue.
This is great. And one of the things that... Without, and I don't want to intellectualize this too much because I feel like that hasn't necessarily helped me in the past. Obviously, it does need to be partly intellectual. I acknowledge that. But one thing I've tried to do is when opportunities present themselves or when I'm trying to work out priorities and my decisions for getting those things done are, I need to do this because it will really help someone else.
Mm-hmm.
God, this will make me sound really... ungenerous. I hope that isn't the case.
I don't think anyone would think that you're ungenerous in any way.
Thank you, Nick. Or I need to do this because of the money. This is important because of the money.
Yep.
Or all of these things that I need to do for a reason that is outside of myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just to try to make decisions, I guess, based on my gut and mm-hmm. what feels right. Or, okay. you know, it's just, it's a big learning, but I'm just, it's more that I'm trying to shift my attention from this idea of reacting to things to being proactive.
And have you put that in place since we've spoken? Is this something that you're looking to this month, or have you, the past month has
oh,
been?
Oh, no, this has been the last month.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, and how has it been going?
A couple of steps forward.
Yeah.
A couple of steps back.
Yeah, of course.
But it definitely has shifted this month, and I really do feel like it's been a busy month, but I'm really sitting here today feeling like I'm not conscious of that level of burnout that I was
Great.
Conscious of last month or have been previously.
Yes.
And one of those things is that during the month, I mm-hmm. have been keeping track of the things that I'm going to mention for the podcast.
You have been pretty amazing. We have this wonderful document that we pulled together for the bookends, and it's something we can both edit. I must admit, Lauren, there's some wonderful detail in the bookends this month. So well, it's working.
Yeah. So in this sense of being proactive, whenever I've had sort of an epiphany or something shifted, I've tried to document that. So rather than getting to the end of the month and going, oh, wow, lots happened. What was it?
Mm.
I have a little list. I've started writing.
Fantastic.
Again. And there's various projects at the moment that I need to be writing for.
Yep.
And I'm just writing a little bit for each of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm working on making that a habit and getting back into that. So that's
Great.
Been really exciting.
Yeah, that is exciting.
I have been focusing on fitness and training for the work I do in Bali each year, which starts
oh, fantastic.
With the mountain climb.
So that's getting close.
That is getting close. And I have, I guess successfully, as in I was still alive at the end, done the climb that the training begins with in previous years. But I would like to do it and feel a bit more on top of that fitness-wise, so that then when I go into the training, I'm coming at it from a strong place.
And listeners would know about your yearly trip to Bali. It's one of those things, isn't it, that's I think now that we've done nearly 2 years of podcasting just over, we might have mentioned it.
Yeah.
Twice. This could be the third time.
Yes. Oh, that I'm going. The third
yeah.
time. I think I mention it all the time. But yes, this is my fourth year
yes.
of returning to Bali to do this work with the fantastic Ali T. Miller. And oh, the other thing that's been going on this month is
yes.
I have had a flurry of auditions.
Fantastic.
Which was really exciting, but also really interesting because I had a number of auditions in quite a short space of time. And, of course, anyone that you speak to at that time is like, oh, what are you up to? And I said, oh, well, you know, I've had some auditions. And people respond and they say, oh, great, your acting career is really taking off. Oh, it's really building up to, it's really starting, isn't it? Which is funny because I've obviously been acting for a long time
yeah.
now. So that's an interesting perspective. And then a week later, when you don't have any auditions on that week, people say, oh, well, that's okay. Don't worry. There'll be more auditions soon. You just need to wait for that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like,
and nothing, from week to week, nothing has actually significantly changed in my career or how I approach yes. it or my motivation. Or But there's
people's
this seesaw effect in people's perspectives, which yeah. I just thought was worth referencing.
I think every actor can well, knows that feeling of people going, oh, yes, no, your acting career is really taking off now,
yeah,
isn't
yeah.
it?
And now it yeah. stops. And what about you, Nick? You sound a little run down, so I imagine you've been quite busy.
Yeah, I guess so. This month has been all about my wonderful trip to Japan. So I do want to talk about that really quickly because I went with expectations. I have this thing that I do with travel that I talk about a lot on this podcast where I think you should travel somewhere at least once a year and experience a new culture, and it just gets you out of your comfort zone and looking at things differently, right?
Yeah.
And Japan was the next one on my hit list, much to the dismay originally of my girlfriend Roxy.
Oh.
She wasn't too keen on Japan originally, and it just kind of hit me and I said, no, I think we have to do Japan. That's our next trip. She was lovely enough to humour me and go. And I think we both, our expectations of Japan were completely blown out of the water. Like, oh. It was better than we expected. I think I knew that it was going to be a great trip, but when you get there, and this is one of the things I think that will be interesting for listeners if you haven't been to Japan, and if you have, great. But this idea of storytelling in their society is so lovely It's everywhere. I want to make particular note of, we went and saw a wonderful show, a geisha show, at a wonderful place in Gion in Kyoto. And that particular show had been running for hundreds of years, and I'm trying to think exactly how many years it was, but the history and the way that they tell stories was completely different. And I didn't speak a word of Japanese, and watching the show, I still knew exactly what was going on. You know what I mean? And you're making your own, you're getting your own perspective of the show, if that makes sense. And it was so lovely, because the way that they move, the way that they tell the stories, whilst it was familiar, was completely different in another sense too. So it's just really lovely to go and experience that, because it's so ingrained in their culture, the idea of the geisha and what it means.
Those archetypes.
Yeah. And what I found most interesting was the movement, the physical movement of the geishas and the way that they moved, which is very not something we see a lot in Australia. The small movements.
Very disciplined.
It was just really interesting to see.
The other thing that came out of Japan was that you wrote a really beautiful blog about an experience that you had there.
Yeah, that was amazing. And once again, I think in that particular blog I wrote about not necessarily knowing a heap about, you know, I'm not Buddhist. I think it's Shinto is another religion. I'm not either of those. But to go to the temples, I still had this amazing sort of feeling and energy running through me. It's amazing how that can happen, and I don't know anything about Shinto religion. Do you know what I mean? Yes. But I still get that feeling. Yes. So places like that are very special, and that's what I mean about going to places and experiencing something completely different.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And for anyone who would like to check out Nick's blog, it's
please do.
Under the it's on the cultural temperature page of our website.
Indeed.
And so since you've been back?
Yeah, I came back mid-month, and I must admit I've probably lacked a little bit of motivation since being back, and I think that sometimes is natural after a trip like that. It's almost like you step away from your usual routine, and then coming back to your usual routine is kind of hard. So I think the few weeks that I have been back, I've probably not been the usual Nick, if that makes sense.
Yeah, which isn't a bad thing. I mean, it's just a sign that your perspective does shift
when
you have amazing experiences like that. And it's just like, okay, so how do I move forward with the new things that the new knowledge and things that I hold.
Yeah, that's really so lovely exciting. Way to put it, actually. So that's kind of been, I like to think of it like that rather than just, oh yeah, you've been lacking motivation. I like what you said, Lauren.
I also find it really interesting when you talk about the performance that you saw in Japan, this idea that even though you didn't speak Japanese, you could understand the story that they were telling. Yeah. And I really feel this month's podcast guest, the fabulous Douglas Briggs, that we will speak to very shortly, there's that real sense of, obviously, in his heritage, the idea of passing down concepts that that we understand on other levels.
Yeah, and timeless, generation to generation type stories that we're talking about. And let's get straight into it. Let's do it. Here we are, podcast 24. Enjoy.
We are here today with Aboriginal presenter and public speaker Douglas Briggs. Welcome, Douglas.
Yay.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you.
Absolute pleasure. And first of all, I guess I would like to pay my respects to the land that I'm currently on, the people of the Gadigal Nation. And both you and Lauren are in Melbourne at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. We're just currently here sitting at Trinity College. And I want to pay my respects to the elders and many Aboriginal people that walk on the lands of, you know, Melbourne and the various surrounding suburbs. The Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, as a proud Yorta Yorta man, and it's a great privilege to be here and standing on and continuing to learn and educate myself, as many Wurundjeri people have done so for 60,000 plus years. So I pay my respects to them.
And I pay my respects too. I certainly feel privileged to be here tonight. We are, of course, here at Trinity College at Melbourne University, where you're studying at the moment, I think.
Yeah, that's correct. Currently studying here at Melbourne, Melbourne University, and living here as well at Trinity College. So it's a different experience than the average university student, I'd say.
Yeah, and Dougie, why have we chosen this particular location today?
Yeah, awesome. I think, for one, Trinity College is it's an interesting place to be. I think, obviously, there's a lot of post-colonisation historical significance here, being the first residential college of the University of Melbourne. Mm-hmm. Also the fact that Trinity College is home to, I guess, many great people that have played a great part in, I guess, Australian history
as a collective. And it's, I guess, me being an Aboriginal man and studying and living here. It's I think it's interesting, I guess, to the full circle almost, I think, of where it's come from.
Fantastic.
To get us started, obviously, you and Nick have a bit of history.
Yes.
And we've just met this evening and caught up a little bit. But we'd love to get you to read your story so that our listeners know where we're coming from tonight.
Certainly. I'm a proud Yorta man, and I pay homage to my hometown of Shepparton in North Victoria. But I was born and raised, I guess, around the various suburbs of Melbourne. Lived over in the eastern suburbs in Ringwood for a little bit, then finished my schooling up at St Kilda College. I'm the eldest child of four, and thus the eldest grandchild on both sides of my family. So, yeah, Mum had me quite young. She was 16, turning 17, and Dad was 19, turning 20, so very young. But, yeah, currently in my first year doing a Bachelor of Arts from the University of Melbourne, as I said before, living on residence at Trinity College. I'm looking to complete a double major in political science as well as Indigenous studies. And outside of my studies, I work as a national presenter with AIM Mentoring and also pour a few beers on the weekends at the Terminus Hotel in Abbotsford.
Yeah. Bit of everything.
Bit of everything. Just keep myself busy, always.
Excellent.
So I'm also involved with the Koora Youth Council. I'm one of its Nanjit Balert executive members. So Nanjit Balert and Wee Wurrung language, that's the language of the Wurundjeri people. Nanjit meaning leader and Balert meaning strong. And so we sit as the peak advocacy group to the state government for young Indigenous peoples around Victoria.
Fantastic. Look, I'm really looking forward to this. As Lauren has already mentioned, we know each other, and so I think it's okay. The listeners know that I call you Dougie.
Yes, exactly.
First of all, I was just rocking out with Dougie straight away, so in case you're wondering, we do know each other. And I'm really looking forward to this because, knowing you and how passionate you are in regards to your culture and how well you speak about it, this is going to be a really great interview. And I do want to start after hearing your story right at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in Shepparton.
Yep.
And then, as you said, you then moved to Melbourne. What was it like growing up, first of all, in Shepparton, and how was the move to the big city after that?
Yeah, so we lived in Shepparton for a couple of years before. So it's interesting. So lived in Shepparton for a couple of years, and then my uncle got drafted to West Coast Eagles, David Report, and so Mum and Dad moved over when I was a young fella to Perth to help him out and just suss that out, to help him sort of settle in. And then before my second eldest brother, Coolin, was born, we moved back to Shep Mum wanted to raise him with back home, and I think they were missing home as well. So Shep itself, it was, I mean, from my memory, it was amazing. It was beautiful. And me being around, well, being on country, for first of all, was an awesome experience in itself. Then just being around family. I just remember my childhood constantly being around family. There'd be like Mum and Dad being the eldest and second eldest in their respective families, that have all my cousins come through and all my uncles come through and stay over and whatnot. So it was an awesome experience. And then the move to Melbourne just before I started primary school, just for education and, I guess, opportunities, it was interesting in the sense that when I moved to Melbourne, we were in Ringwood, and I had some of my older cousins at the primary school that I went to. And so that was awesome because there wasn't much of a change in the sense of being around family. Family's always played a massive part of my life, and did my schooling all the way through, all from primary school and all the way at the same primary school.
And with that idea of being around family, you mentioned that as the eldest of four, you felt that you wanted to set a positive example for your younger siblings. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, certainly. So, as I said before, Mum and Dad both had me where they were quite young. Neither of them finished their high schooling, and so I thought I had to set the expectation, as year 12 being the expectation.
Yeah.
And so it was all about making sure that they had, I guess, positive role models to look up to as well. And by no way am I saying that Mum and Dad were negative role models. They were absolutely sacrificed everything for, I guess, myself and my three younger siblings. But in terms of, like, academics and wanting to achieve some stuff within, I guess, the education system, I really wanted to ensure that they had someone to look up to.
Yeah. And going off the back of that, your heritage is of the Yorta Yorta people, which are obviously Indigenous Australians whose traditional lands actually lie either side of the Murray River, which is from, I believe, around about Kuna, which is near my hometown, funnily enough, all the way to Albury-Wodonga. We're talking about towns, Echuca, Shepparton, which you've already mentioned, Benalla, Corowa, Wangaratta, And all the way through to Deniliquin. Have I got that right?
That's right. The rough sort of areas. You've nailed it, Kane.
Excellent, mate. Excellent. I've done my research.
That's it.
Can you talk to us about your involvement as a proud Yorta Yorta man and the heritage and what it means to you?
Yeah, for me, I think the Yorta Yorta people in general have been very, I suppose, active within the political sort of sector in terms of a number of things that we've done as a peoples to ensure the betterment of our peoples. So for me, it's just about carrying on that tradition of not really fighting as such. I mean, I don't really like to use that word, but more just ensuring that my generation, the generations to come, have a future that was better than the one before us.
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, a number of things that we've done as a peoples to ensure that we're standing up for what we believe in and standing up for what's right.
And in terms of that heritage and what your parents brought to your childhood, did you feel there was a lot of creativity growing up?
It's interesting. I never really thought about that, to be honest. I think I would never consider myself a creative person in the sense of, I don't know, performing arts or art or whatever that may be. But in terms of just being celebrating our culture in different ways, I guess I've done traditional dance ever since I could walk. And so throughout NAIDOC Week and Reconciliation Weeks, I would dance with my uncle and my dad and my cousins at different gigs and events. So, I'm not really sure how to answer that question, to be honest with you, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just, we're just really interested in when you're growing up, what the influences were. And I love this idea that you grew up doing dance. That's just something that you do. You don't necessarily think, oh, that was an artistic pastime I added to, you know, like we, in our, in society, the idea of art can be separated.
Yeah, right.
And storytelling and culture can be separated from more practical business, economic, those sort of things. So it's really nice to view it as just something that is more part of who you are.
Yeah, absolutely. I never really thought about that. That's exactly right. It was just something that we just did as children. It wasn't anything exceptional or different or out of the ordinary. It was something that was just natural, I suppose, and it's just the way that we practiced our culture.
And kind of why this podcast, we were so keen to get you on as well, Dougie, was that idea of that, you know, storytelling is so central to your heritage and to your culture that it's almost like it's your day-to-day, so you don't think of it as a creative pursuit, as Lauren said. So it's going to be interesting to hear a bit more about that.
Yeah, and it's interesting hearing you speak about the leaders from the Yorta Yorta people. Mm-hmm. A small group of Yorta Yorta people, in response to the legacy of colonisation, as you said, have been active in the community, and particularly in setting up some of the first Aboriginal organisations in Australia, which include things like the Aborigines Progressive Association in Sydney in 1937, the Australian Aborigines League in Melbourne in 1932, and this was responsible for raising the awareness of the general community to the plight of the Aboriginal people, including demanding that Aboriginal people be given full citizenship rights, the right to land, self-determination, and the right to retain their own unique cultural identity. So social justice and equity were a major part of their policy objectives, and the issue of land rights and compensation were at the forefront of their struggles. And you've already mentioned it, your forebears certainly set a very strong example for you. Now, the top two skills that you've been endorsed for on LinkedIn are public speaking and leadership. Growing up, did you have any sense that this would be true for you?
Not really. Not at all. I'll be honest. I was sort of didn't really come into my skills, if you want to call them that, as a leader or as a speaker until year 9. I think that was sort of the breaking point for me. Up until then, I was sort of happy to go with the crowd. I remember in grade 6... a lot of my friends said, Dougie, you should go for like school captain, or you should go for sports captain. And I was like, nah. Like, only the tryhards do that. Like, nah.
Oh, so you were too cool at that point.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah,
gotcha.
And then,
so you're not cool anymore.
No, I'm just one of those tryhards.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess in year 9, it was sort of that crossroads where I could sit back and still try and be that cool cat, or I could actually stand up and, the space where I was at the moment going to school at Taylor's Lake Secondary College was that I was the only Aboriginal person within my year level, and at least well, the only one that we identified. And a lot of my mates constantly had questions of me. Some of them come from a space of arrogance and ignorance.
Yep.
And there was some of the tougher questions that were borderline racist. And then a lot of my friends were just, I guess, truly just interested in and were curious about what it was to be an Aboriginal person. And so for me, standing up as at that point was about, you know what, I'm going to try and, one, break down those stereotypes that many of wider Australia have of Aboriginal people and really sort of set the example of what it means to, for me to be a leader and who I am as a person.
So that was really an inspiration once you started to get to the Essendon Key Law College and started to, I guess, face a few challenges as an Aboriginal man. That really sort of spurred you on.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So I moved to EKC in year 10. And even as, I guess, a student who was new to the school, I had a lot of friends there. So I felt quite comfortable in stepping up in that environment and being that leader per se. It was something that I'd wanted to pursue, and not only just formal roles, I guess, as you know, being on the Student Representative Council and that sort of thing, but also just in terms of, you know, we're part of the football program at EKC, and so I always try to speak up within the footy and try. I mean, I've never been part of that ladsy culture that you find of in footy. I've been about trying to bring down that sort of environment, but to make sure that it was respectful in any certain way. So informally, you know, just amongst chats with the boys, as you would have it, I suppose.
Yeah.
And so from your studies at EKC...
That's right.
from there, you went on to study a Bachelor of Arts in Communications and Media Study at Melbourne Uni. Mm. But then you finished that, or you switched before?
No, so the story goes is that I, straight out of high school, got the opportunity to study here at Melbourne. So I guess it was my top preference. It was the only one I was really interested in. To be honest, I listed all these other preferences, but it was...
Was that a big thing too?
Absolutely. It was, my heart was set on it. And, you know, the year 12 was quite a significant year in terms of just the balancing act between responsibilities and roles I had as school captain and then my own personal studies. And towards the end of the year, I really burnt out, to be honest. And so I didn't do as well as I anticipated, but I felt like I worked hard enough to get to Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And so, when I got that letter, I got that little... letter in the mail saying I've been accepted, it was the greatest day. So 2013, 2014, I was studying here. And throughout those 2 years, I'd say I faced quite a lot of, I guess, turmoil and parents separated in my first semester at uni. And that's something that's sort of still affecting me to now. And there's many challenges that happens within a separation.
Of course.
And I think for me, I was living on campus at the time. So I was really conflicted as to how much I could help out and what I could do. And so it was sort of like, well, what am I doing with myself right now? It made me question a lot of why I was doing what I was doing as well. So that's sort of in there. And then the second semester, once I sort of felt like things were back on track again, one of my older cousins passed away tragically at the age of 28. And then it was all like, well, shit, fuck, where am I going? What am I doing here? There's like real things happening out in the world, and here I am living on campus in this sort of bubble of residential colleges, and it's sort of like, well, this isn't real. Like, there's more things that are happening outside. And so I was like, do I actually want to be at college or not? So I chose to move out into that year, moved in with my dad, and then in the second semester in 2014, one of my closest friends, Josh Hardy, passed away. He was tragically murdered out front of a McDonald's King Hit in St Kilda. So it was sort of at end of 2014, I'd not done well academically. I'd failed a lot of subjects just because, you know, I went through some depression and through those sort of things, those mental illnesses, and thought, you know what, one, I'm wasting my own time. I've just wasted the 2 years of my life by not really committing myself to uni because I don't want to commit myself to uni. And then two, I'm going to even just put myself in more hex debt by just slaving away and pretending that everything's okay. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to withdraw from my course. I withdrew it in 2014. And last year, spent the year sort of, well, what am I going to do with myself? I want to be working, but I don't want to just be working to pay bills. I want to be doing something and giving back to community. And I, you know, throughout 2014, I was Mr. NAIDOC of Victoria. And so that was a role that I'd really cherished. And I sort of wanted to utilize, I guess, my public speaking skills in another way. And that's when the opportunity came with AIM Mentoring. So...
I mean, you've just delivered your whole like life there. That was
we
fantastic.
Actually should relax. I think we should ask less questions.
I know. I was far out, man. But as you said, 2014 was wow. What a year of extremes for you.
Absolutely.
But I guess Mr. Naidoc was a big part of 2014, which we do want to talk about.
Yep.
The origins for listeners, the origins of the annual Naidoc celebrations originated from Aboriginal rights groups boycotting Australia Day in the 1920s.
That's right.
Out of which the Day of Mourning was born.
Yep.
From about 1940 to 55, the Day of Mourning was held annually on the Sunday before Australia Day and was known as Aborigines Day. But in 1955, the day was shifted to the first Sunday in July after it was decided it should not just be, you know, a protest day, but also a celebration of Aboriginal culture. At the same time, the second Sunday in July became a day of remembrance for Aboriginal people and their heritage. So by 1974, it was decided that the event should cover the entire week.
Yes.
Can you, Mr. Naidoc is a big deal and you had a heap to do as a part of that. Can you explain to us or share with us what it was like being Mr. Naidoc for 2014?
So Mr. and Miss Naidoc as well, a man and a woman are appointed. So it's two people who are considered, I guess, aspiring young leaders within the Aboriginal community. And, you know, age between, I think it's 16 and 25 or 18 and 25. I need to correct myself on that one. But, yeah, you sort of go through this application process. You write down a thing as to why you, what you've done, what your achievements are, and why you believe you should be meeting Mr. Naidoc. And then you have a little presentation night and you speak in front of the rest of the community. There's like maybe 200 community members there, most of them your family, depending on how big your family is and whatnot. And then, so that happens the week before Naidoc week. And then, well, from my week where I was there, we were put up in a hotel. And from the first Sunday to the Saturday night, it was just nonstop with appearances. Like, you know, we had all these different appearances at different Victorian Aboriginal organisations. We had appearances with the state government. You know, had the opportunity to speak at a flag raising ceremony in Federation Square. Yeah. Had an opportunity to speak at, on a Wednesday night, the government has it's at the Premier's presentation of something along those lines. And so,
so it's basically like an opportunity as a young Aboriginal person to get your voice heard.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what you speak about. Up on anything that you, I guess, any issues that you see important or anything that you really want to, it's a platform for you to really make it your own, I suppose. And it's your opportunity to really share your voice in that.
And did you find that fairly easy, Doug? Did it come quite naturally at that point?
Yeah, I mean, and it was not through, like, I'll be honest. So, like, for example, when I spoke up at the state government night on Wednesday night, I'd left my speech back at the hotel room. And so I had to sort of wing it, per se. And,
yeah, I do remember this story.
Yeah. And so I don't even know how I did it, to be honest with you, but it just sort of came from the heart in the end. And
I spoke
for like 5 minutes and received a standing ovation from the rest of the crowd. And it was just...
Do you know what you said?
I couldn't be able to tell you at all. I think I put it on, because it was Dennis Napthorne at the time. He was the Premier. And I think the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs was a guy by the name of Tim Bull. And I put it on him. I called them out and said, it's all well and good having these great schemes around closing the gap and all these ambitious, tokenistic, I guess, programs. The grassroots level of it is that we're not doing enough. There's more Aboriginal children in out-of-home care than there was during the, you know, stolen generations. And so sort of I pretty much put on them and said, what are you really going to do to improve it? And not just, what are your actions? I think is what I said, something along those lines. And yeah, it was awesome. It was an awesome feeling. But I think you can sort of tell when someone speaks with passion and speaks with honesty.
Almost better than if you had brought your notes, maybe.
I think so. Yeah. So
that's interesting too. When you mentioned Close the Gap Day, I've been doing some work with Oxfam recently.
Yep.
We're heavily involved in National Close the Gap Day.
Yeah.
And in terms of events that were held nationally this year, I can't remember the exact figures, but there were so many more this year. So I feel like in terms of awareness of the day, statistically that seems to be growing. Do you feel like since you made that speech in 2014 that you feel the sense of more happening?
Yeah, I do. And I think I'm more aware of what's happening as well. To be honest and to be quite transparent, I guess I said that at the time, not entirely, I think speaking from personal experience, but not entirely sure of whether the actions that were actually going were actually true or not. I just spoke from my personal opinion as to where we were going. Mm-hmm. But I do feel that it's something that's ever improving. But I think
I mean, it's my own personal opinion. I only speak, again, from what I know, but I think some of these issues that Aboriginal people, Indigenous people in Australia face are so complex, and they're not Indigenous issues. I don't like to use that term. They're not exclusive to Indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
They're just issues that happen to our people in the same way that, I guess, people from other backgrounds also face them as well. But these issues are very complex, and they're not just... They have a number of different sort of areas that you need to sort of look at if you want to try and solve them or help create a better place for them. So
not an easy fix, but very important to be working on irrespective of that.
Exactly right. It's sort of like this whole idea of, well... Health is one that a major one that constantly gets brought up, and how do you improve someone's health, and what do you need to do to improve someone's health? And it's sort of like, well, at the same time, if a person is unhealthy, why are they unhealthy? Are they uneducated? Yeah. Do they not know what to eat and what not to eat?
Yeah, what are the root causes?
Or is it then a case of, well, the fact is that they may not have the money to go out and buy the fruit and vegetables or some of the more pricier things that you need to. You know, you got all these different, like gourmet or organic, all these different things you have nowadays.
Yeah.
Is it the fact that they may not be working and able to provide those sort of things for their families?
That's right.
It's sort of, yeah, it's a multifaceted sort of issue that you can't fix with one way.
So there's something that I would really like to discuss. I think it's commonly recognised that European colonisation had a devastating impact on traditional Indigenous Australians, including groups such as the Yorta Yorta. And within the first generation of the European invasion, the Yorta Yorta population of some 5,000 to 6,000 was reduced by 85%. So coming from that, I am an individual who is lucky enough to live in this country. And increasingly, I find the idea of Australia Day difficult. I've grown up seeing it as a day to celebrate with my friends that we live in this amazing country. However, I also recognise that for many Australians, it's actually a very sad day.
Mm.
You yourself have written on social media about how the day marks the beginning of the loss of language, the loss of law, and the loss of cultural practices. It marks the beginning of the massacres, the beginning of assimilation, and the beginning of the taking of lands that were never ceded. So, being aware that I don't know as much about Indigenous Australian history as I would like, but wanting to approach all of this with the utmost respect and to find a way to be able to celebrate the great things in my life with you and you celebrating the great things in your life, what are your thoughts on finding a way to bridge the gap so that future generations can celebrate the country together?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a really great question. And I think I've been thinking about this a lot, actually. And there's a number of ways which I think we can go about it. If you think about the way that Aboriginal history is taught within the schooling system, I remember growing up, it was maybe we spent 2 weeks on Aboriginal history and it was all textbook. And I found myself teaching the class and correcting the teacher on the pronunciations and whatnot. And I understand that within the curriculum, the teachers have a hard job. They have the world's hardest job. I respect that much. But if you're teaching, if you're in an environment where you don't have an Aboriginal person like myself be able to correct and teach and share those stories, then you're never going to be exposed to those stories, right? So I think there just needs to be a whole complete uplifting of how we teach Aboriginal history. And you know, I'm going to correct myself, it's not Aboriginal history, it's Australian history, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
all the same history.
Yep.
It's all one history, and all it is post-colonisation and pre-colonisation. And I think Australia needs to go to acknowledge that, and not just acknowledge but actually put in some things within place. I think prior to that it was all just swept on the carpet, and it's still something that tends to be swept on the carpet nowadays. So I think So there needs to be some sort of reform within the education system about how we teach it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I spent more time learning Italian than I did learning anything to do with my Aboriginal culture and history. So then I think that's one sort of way that you can approach it. Because once it's taught, then you become more... I mean, I've got this saying where...
It becomes part of what you know.
Exactly, right. And you only know what you know until you've been exposed to something else,
I mean, this is a big discussion at the moment too, but Australia Day, does it need to change?
I think it does. I think it does. For as long as the date is January 26th,
yep,
that date will always have a negative impact for Aboriginal people.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the fact that we create, you know, 3% of the population is irrelevant. It's always going to be either, depending on how that individual looks at it, a day of survival or the day of invasion, right? Me, myself, personally, I think it's interesting. I see both sides. I see both sides. And for me, you know, the day of survival sort of looks at, we are still here as peoples. We're continuing to practice our culture and practice our law, and we're still strong. But in the sense that we haven't gone, whereas I feel like day of invasion is more in your face, and sometimes people don't like in your face.
Yeah.
And I respect the people who are that way as well. So I think it needs to be changed. And I remember reading something that said, you know, well, what date do you want to change it to? What other date would be preferable? I said, well, maybe the date hasn't been found yet, because maybe the date that we become a republic, you know, a republic of this country, maybe that's the date where we celebrate our national identity and what it means to be Australian. Maybe we celebrate on the day where Eddie Mabo, or the Eddie Mabo case for land rights within Australia, and where Australia was no longer considered terra nullius. Maybe we look at that date as a day.
There's plenty of dates.
There's no issue on dates.
And this is the thing. I think, like any, because I mean, this is a political issue at the moment, isn't it? It's really a politicized issue. And I think, like anything, certainly in, I can only speak from my own personal experience too, that I think my social circles awareness of Australia Day at the moment not being a great day to celebrate the country is getting stronger.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I can only speak from that, but I think that's the whole thing with a political issue. When it becomes a political issue, is the stronger that voice gets,
absolutely,
the more chance it will of being rectified. Well, I am going to move on because there's a heap that I want to cover here.
No worries.
Is there anything else you want to mention on that before we do move on?
No, I was just going to say that I even think for wider Australia, the Australia Day has lost its meaning. It went from being a day of where we celebrated Captain Cook's arrival and colonisation to be fair, just a big piss up, right?
Yeah.
A day where we got the day
listening
off
to Triple J Hottest 100 at the moment, isn't it?
If anything, that's what, I mean, I've always sort of celebrated Australia Day with my family. We go down to, there's like Survival Day celebrations within the city.
Yep.
And that's what it meant to me. I was just being around family, being around culture. And the Triple J, well, since I guess I had a little bit of a thing with AIM Mentoring, partnering with it this year, I had an interest there. But exactly. You listen to Triple J, you chuck the Hottest 100 on, get mates around, and you'd be draped in Australian flags and have a few beers and a barbie, right? That's the idea. That's the generic Australia Day celebrations. And I think it's sort of gone from what it used to be in the past. And so if it's lost that traditional sense, then why the fuss about changing it to another day? I don't know. That's just my thoughts.
And you did in that speak a little bit about your work as a mentor for AIM, which is the Australian Indigenous Mentoring Experience. So from humble beginnings in 2005, AIM is now connecting around about 5,700 mentees to about 1,900 mentors around Australian universities. How did you become involved as a starting point?
Yeah, so back to last year where I was thinking, you know, I want to be actually doing something that's going to be able to not only pay the bills but also be connected back within community. And so I had a few friends that were working for AIM Mentoring down here in Victoria. And just through the traps, found that there was a job opening up as a presenter. And I'd never had any, I guess, affiliation with AIM beforehand. It was never at my school. And so I was like, oh, well, don't know what this is, but this sounds like an awesome opportunity. I know the people that are working there are awesome people. So it's like, why not? And then, so then my role as a presenter was to, I guess, facilitate the workshops that we have. So we have, you know, a number of program days throughout the year for years 7 to 12. And on those workshops, we bring the mentees, so the students, the high school students themselves, onto the university campus. And then that's where we have the university students who are the mentors, and they volunteer their time. And it's about, I guess, one, it challenges the mentor's idea of what it is to be an Aboriginal person, challenges their any notions and stereotypes they may have had.
Yep.
And I guess a lot of the time they're wanting to learn. And so they're learning by doing in that sense. And then for the high school students, it shows that university isn't a big, bad, scary place, and that, you know, if people like your mentors here are willing to have a yarn with you in a chat, then it's a place where you can also find yourself in the future if you're willing to work for it. So, yeah, it's awesome. It's all about, I guess, for me anyway, these mentees are born superheroes, right? This is a saying we use. They're born superheroes, and we just teach them how to fly. And we're just here to help them through their high school journey.
Really cool.
Excellent. So moving on, another role that you have, or that you just completed, actually, was you got to interview Indigenous Australian rules footballer Adam Goods, who was, he's an Australian rules footballer, but he was also 2014 Australian of the Year. And you interviewed him at the 2016 Koori Youth Summit. How was that?
Can I say that was one of the most amazing experiences. So I am a massive fan, and Adam Goods is one of my idols, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Hated him when he played West Coast in the grand finals. Couldn't stand him because he was such a gun. But I'm a West Coast fan, if you hadn't gathered it by now. but just how he stood up and believed in what was right, what he believed was right. And so interviewing him was just an amazing experience, in the sense that it was like speaking to, it's like one of my brother boys. And I guess a brother boy is a slang term for like one of your best mates. And the sense that, you know, so humble and so down to earth, but when he speaks, he just speaks with such amazing charisma and has his presence about him that's inspiring. And so that opportunity came about. So the Koori Youth Summit is something that is in its third year now, and it brings young Indigenous people from all over Victoria together to network and connect, and to have a yarn about some of the issues and some of the achievements that we're going on in our own communities. And it's all about giving us a platform to speak up on these issues and these achievements, and highlighting them within that stage. So,
I was going to say, how good to have him there.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
I think Adam, and you've already kind of alluded to this already, for the listeners who generally, let's say that listeners are generally an arts crowd, so probably don't follow the football too much. Adam was part of a infamous sort of booing saga that was part of the final parts of his career at the Sydney Swans. And no matter what the belief on why the booing happened or whatever, it certainly sparked a debate in the country around deep-seated racism in Australia. Mm. And it was interesting because I guess he, as you said, he's a courageous, he stood up for himself. And how important are people like that, celebrities, outspoken celebrity, proud individuals like that, in going to a summit like the Koori Youth Summit and speaking, to peers and the younger generation?
Absolutely. I think it was, for a lot of people there, it was, they were also inspired, and it showed them that to continue to fight for what they believe in, whatever that is.
Was that his main message? Was that
so we spoke about a range of things. So with an interview, there were no things that were off limit. So we spoke about the booing and why and how it affected him. We spoke about what sort of support systems he had in place to ensure that, you know, he was okay. We spoke about his life after footy and the things that he's involved with. We spoke about him and his Aboriginality and how he came to be so strong and so proud. We spoke about what it means to be a leader and the expectations you have of yourself. And, you know, in that room, there was, a room full of young Aboriginal prospective leaders and what that means. So we had all these different discussions, and it was incredible. It was such an incredible experience.
Sounds very cool.
Talking about important stories, since the beginning of time, storytelling played a vital role in Australian Aboriginal culture, one of the world's oldest cultures, and we would refer to that as the Dreamtime.
Yeah.
I've got some more text here about what Dreamtimes means, but I guess I'm really interested in hearing from you your thoughts on the Dreamtime.
Yeah, sure. So just, I guess, to prefix this thing is that I only ever speak from my own knowledge and personal experience. I by no means claim to be the spokesperson for all things Indigenous culture and whatnot. And it's something that I am continually learning about myself. But I guess knowledge was passed down orally, right? Whether it was men's business, women's business, it was passed down. Everything that your roles and responsibilities as a man or as a woman was told by you through the generations before you and your elders. And so it was always top level down. And whether it would be, for example, where to go and go to go fishing, where's the best spots to fish, whether it's the sacred sites you have, whether it's this is what we need to do when we practice culture. If we're mourning, these are the dances and the songs that we sing. If we're celebrating boy being initiated, becoming into man, these are the practices and cultures. And that was all told through stories and through these Dreamtime stories, I suppose. And a lot of the creative stories that you know, might have been familiar with Bunja being, I guess, creator of the Kulin Nation and mm. and how that came to be. And it's interesting that the stories, and I wish I could be able to tell this little case study properly, but there's this story of how I think it was a serpent came about and he weaved his way through and did all these things and did all these different things within this country. And then these Aboriginal people, this community told the story and told how this is this spot over here, this river goes through here, it connects to this river, da da da. And obviously they didn't have the technology of, like, I guess, a helicopter to see over a few. But mm. they mapped out all of this land, and the helicopters took a photo of it and said, yeah, it matches up perfectly. Wow. You know what I mean? And I wish I could have been able to tell it better, but the idea is that this knowledge was passed down through the stories, yes. right? And this knowledge was passed down over and over and over again. And so that became ingrained within your knowledge. And there's things called song lines as well. And so, you know, you would sing a song and the song would be whatever it may be. And it's like you need to walk this far. And then once you get to this stage, you'll be at this point. You'll be at a crossroads between such and such. And you got to go this way. And so all the song lines, all the stories, all the dance, all the culture was taught through that, which is something that, I wish I still had as ingrained as, I guess, some of my fellow Aboriginal brothers and sisters up north and mm. where in places where the assimilation didn't happen until more recently, I suppose.
When we look at storytelling, mm. the whole reason we tell stories is to give meaning.
Yeah, right.
So I think that's so strong, especially in Aboriginal culture, the giving meaning to not only, I guess, the land,
yeah,
but also to the generations, making sure that the story is passed on effectively. That's where storytelling really fits.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've been doing a bit of research recently on... I like to...
You always do research,
Well, one
Lauren.
Of the things I find really exciting about these interviews is the opportunity to immerse yourself in different areas of art than I normally would find the opportunity to. But so I was doing a bit of research on Yorta Yorta artists, and I came across this guy, Lynn Onus.
Yeah.
Lynn Onus is sort of recognised as playing a really pivotal role in the expression of Aboriginal art as a contemporary and dynamic art mm-hmm. form. And he went on a personal pilgrimage to Arnhem Land with some fellow artists who are quite well known, about which he later wrote, and I'm going to quote this: "These artists have experienced a profound and cathartic change, both personally and artistically. The deep spiritual relationship between the people of Arnhem Land and their environment has reawakened and magnifies each artist's relationship with their homeland." And just from hearing you talk about the Dreamtime and your, I guess, yearning for more understanding of that connection, how do you reawaken that sense of connection to, as you said, Nick, each other and the land?
Yeah, great question. I guess that's something that I'm continually struggling with myself, and so how I actually go about literally practicing my own culture. And to be honest, I think I don't have that answer for it. I wish I could. I wish, you know, it's something that even just learning language. So I know a few words, and like one of my uncles, he speaks it quite fluently, but there aren't that many Yorta Yorta people who do speak Yorta Yorta language fluently. And that's something that I wish was, I guess, revitalised, the language. Mm. I think language plays a big part in your identity and being able to express yourself, right?
For sure.
I don't know. I feel like whenever I go back home, I'll go back up to Shep, I just have this sense of belonging and this feeling. And even though, to be quite sincere, the only reasons why I do go up to Shep sometimes is for funerals and for those sort of sad grievings and mournings. And so, but whenever I go up there, I just feel like this is home, right? And I don't know how to express that and to articulate the words that I feel. It's just like, this is home, this is where I'm meant to be in that given moment. And so whenever I go back there, I just that reawakening, I suppose.
Yeah.
That thirst for wanting to learn more about my language and my culture is just picked up again, I suppose.
Yeah. It's as simple as going back.
Yeah, as simple as going back. Just being on the banks of the Murray River and just...
Yep.
That's all I need, you know? And I wish I'd do it more, and I'll try... I've been trying for like the last couple months to actually make a consolidated effort to go back up and just go away for a weekend or whatever it may be. But yeah, to answer your question, I'm still trying to figure out how I go about doing that.
Yeah, well, I'm still trying to figure that stuff out too, if it helps.
And I think that leads really lovely into the future, Dougie. Mm-hmm. I know that you've mentioned, I think on LinkedIn, your desire to break down stereotypes and be a pioneer for the next generation, which was, they're your words. Mm. Can you tell us about what your plans are for the future in regards to your public speaking and maybe, if you can, how you're going to use storytelling to do that?
Yeah, certainly. I guess something that's sort of come about recently as well with, I guess, interviewing Adam Goods and doing these appearances is that... I've always been told that you're such an incredible speaker, Doug, and that you should really get into politics, or you should really be getting into those sort of things. And I've never really been interested in it, to be honest.
I think I've said that to you, Doug.
You've said it a number of times. Yeah, yeah. But I think yeah, the more
one of many.
Yeah, I mean, the more that people get notice it about me, the more I become well, maybe I should. And so I think the future for me, in terms of even just studying politics at the moment. Is a really interesting space. Yeah,
which we didn't mention earlier. We mentioned
doing one of my majors is political science. So I want to see where that comes out of it and see how it looks. I think, yes, to make change, you need to be in that sort of sector. And that's like literal change within the Australian society.
Yep.
But at the same time, I don't want to sort of have to... Well, you know, the saying is that, you know, once you become a politician, it's all about negotiating you end up losing some of the things that you're passionate about. And I don't want to go down that road and then have to sacrifice some of the things that I'm passionate about. And then at the same time, I don't want to be just paintbrush as just an Indigenous politician. But I see the power in that as well. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, finishing my degree is first priority.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to continue to sort of be involved with Koori Youth Council as a platform to speak up on issues. And through that, there's opportunities come about with, you know, meeting with the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs or meeting the Premier and whatnot. And I'm just going to try and be involved and connect and network my way in that. And if something comes up within politics, then I'd certainly pursue it, yeah.
It's worked so far, Dougie. I think, yeah, keep doing what you're doing, right?
Thanks, brother.
So one of the ideas that I've come across recently is that in Aboriginal art, people are often represented by symbols.
Yep.
And often symbols of nature.
Yep.
If you were telling the story of the life of Douglas Briggs and you were to pick a symbol to be your representative in the story, what would it be?
Oh, great question.
Yeah, great question. And I've immediately thrown... So a name... that my uncle, who speaks Yorta Yorta language quite fluently, he gave me the tribal name, Garanyan Waka. And Garanyan Waka in Yorta Yorta language means eagle warrior. And so the wedge-tailed eagle is, I guess, is a beautiful animal, right?
Yep.
And my uncle gave me that name because as the eldest child and the eldest grandchild, it's my role as eagle does to look over my family from above. And so I've always sort of been prone to that. I've always that's actually really true. That's a lot of significance for me, and that actually plays true in everything that I do. As a older brother, so I want to continue to look over my younger siblings and make sure that they're fine and they're nurtured. So I think, it's the story of me is quite intrinsically, like, you know, it plays a big part within the eagle as well, and that looking over and being not only a fierce animal, but someone who's stands very proud and very strong and very tall, and is, I mean, quite majestic in its ways. But but no, that's something that's
just slide that in there.
That's always stayed true to me, and it always just made sense into my story and who I am as a person.
Fantastic,
Doug. Thanks so much for joining us on The Act of Storytelling. It's been wonderful, and
it's been really amazing. Thank you.
I'm sure the listeners are going to get plenty out of it. So thanks again.
No worries. Thank you so much
for both having me. And good luck with everything that comes next.
We'll see how we go.
What an amazing interview.
He's quite an amazing guy, is Doug. And I think my major take out of that interview is, and we were talking about this not long ago, Lauren, about it's sometimes hard. It's hard to fathom that he's 21, right?
Oh, my goodness.
The way that
yes.
he speaks.
Yeah.
And I think he's so honest, authentic, and he speaks with passion. It's so lovely to be around, and it's infectious. And I love the story he told around, because I remember this. I was working with him at the time when he was Mr. NAIDOC, and he went and spoke to all the high dignitaries from around Victoria,
yeah.
including, you know, at the time, the Premier, Dennis Napthine, and he left his notes at home. And you know, that would break some people. You know, go, I've left my notes at home, what am I going to say?
It's like, sorry, I can't go on.
Correct. But Dougie is so happy and so confident, and he speaks with such passion that he knew that if he just was honest and got up there and spoke from the heart, that the right message would come out, and it did. And isn't that a great thing to take out of just trusting yourself?
Oh, absolutely. And also just that the ability to have that openness about where you're coming from.
Yeah.
I know in the training that I've done as a performer in other areas of my life, the teachers that you most respect are the ones where you ask them a question and they say, I don't know.
Mm.
And then they continue to find the answer with you.
With you.
And I feel like that is something that's really present for him.
Mm.
To be honest, this is how I feel. Let's find that answer.
Exactly why he is a great advocate for his people and for closing the gap.
It seems to me like such a simple idea. We were talking about how do we move forward with more awareness of our history. And he talked about the idea that our history is everyone's history.
Yeah.
It's just pre a certain point in time and post a certain point in time. And that a way for us to move forward with that understanding is to have more Aboriginal teaching as part of our education. That just seems to make so much sense.
Does,
to me.
Doesn't it?
So, and a really positive image of something we can work towards. He seems set to make amazing things happen. So no pressure, Dougie.
So, Lauren, talk to me. Your recommendation for this month?
Well, actually, I've got a couple of recommendations to squeeze in.
Yes.
A bit of
multi. You're going to get one. You're going to get a really? Couple. Yeah. No, I'm joking. You can do one. You thought I was serious then. Joking.
Okay. So, first of all, the Human Rights Arts and Film Festival, RAF, has just started on May 5th and is running through to June 8th. And I definitely wanted to do a big shout out to this because I think it's a really important festival. RAF is a not-for-profit arts organisation which looks at exploring diversity and inspiring human stories through film, art, music and obviously forums at the festival. The annual festival focuses on social justice and human rights issues with the idea that, we talk about this a lot on the podcast, artists and creatives have always been at the forefront of social change. RAF believes we rely on the mirror that artists present to us as a society, reflecting a range of stories which can sometimes be uncomfortable, challenging. Mm-hmm. They're about some of the uneasy truths, but they can also be inspiring and hopeful. And I just think it's a really important festival to have in Melbourne.
So it's a Melbourne festival?
Sorry, I should say that it's from opening, it's in Melbourne for a fortnight and then it's touring nationally through Sydney, Brisbane, Darwin, Perth and Alice Springs. So I encourage you to check out the program and see what is on as the festival runs through until June 8th. And it's a pretty amazing program. I know that the festival is opening with the Australian premiere of the highly anticipated Chasing Asylum, and it will close with the Australian premiere of The Bad Kids, which was the 2016 Special Jury Prize winner from Sundance Festival this year. And it looks into the hallways of a Mojave Desert High School, which is devoted to carrying at-risk students over the finish line to graduation. So there's some really fantastic projects as part of this festival, and I highly recommend people check it out. And my other recommendation is a web series called Starting From Now.
Okay.
And I have to admit, I might be a bit behind the eight ball on this one because this is a web series created by award-winning actors graduate Julie Kalchef. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. It explores the lives of four inner Sydney lesbians as they struggle to work out who they are, find a place where they belong, and maybe even find love along the way. That's the little pitch for it. But the first three seasons created an international viral following and reached 20 million viewers in less than 2 years. So that's why I just feel like...
Yeah, and I have heard about this before, and it's interesting. I read an article on this particular show, and it was saying how the rest of the world has really embraced it, but in Australia, because this is an Australian story, the rest of the world is all over this show, and Australia hasn't really embraced it in the same way.
That makes me feel a lot better because I'm not the only late Australian fan to this show. But I just think these guys have... They're telling some great stories. It's a really fantastic example of creating their own content. However, I doubt they need our help promotionally because they've just secured funding from Screen Australia and Screen New Zealand for seasons 4 and 5 and also have acquired broadcast television rights for SBS.
Fantastic.
That started in March. So
so you're behind the eight ball in this one, Lauren. I appreciate it.
I could not
it.
Be further back, but I just really enjoyed it. What have you really enjoyed that you'd like to recommend?
Well, smooth as I can be. Great segue. So I have another book this month that I'd like to recommend. I know that I've been big on recommending books recently.
I think you're going to need to start wearing glasses for this recommendation section.
I think it...
The ones that sit on the end of your nose.
People will be like, he reads a lot of books. I probably read the same amount of, average amount of books, let's be honest. So, but this one's a friend of mine who's just released a book called The Game of Inches. His name is Nigel Collin. And why I wanted to recommend this book is it's really around this idea of small steps leads to big change. And I know that this isn't necessarily a podcast about business or anything like that. But what I love about this book is the way that he's constructed it from a storytelling point of view. He traveled on his motorbike around Australia and he interviewed 80 entrepreneurs. Now, when he says entrepreneurs, that doesn't mean just business. He went around and he interviewed different leaders. So one of particular note was a bloke in Central Australia who taught Indigenous kids how to paint. And I think it's very fitting considering our guest this month. But one of his takeouts was this idea of that he was the keeper of the fire. So the idea is that, so that he's not telling them what to do. He's giving them the fuel for their fire. It's a really lovely message. So it's messages like that in the book. Whether it's something that you're into as far as a business point of view, it doesn't really matter because I think the themes are still very important to everyone.
And isn't that just that methodology for life, regardless of your industry or your path, that small steps can lead to big changes? That definitely crosses the board.
Definitely. So, it's just come out. It's literally just been released. You can get it for about $25.95 at the moment, a signed copy. There you go. Nige will sign it for you. So get involved. It's a great book.
And speaking of small steps for big changes.
You're all over these segues.
What's happening in your month ahead, Nick?
Yeah, this month is an interesting one. The first thing I want to talk about is I'm in discussions with a theatre project in Sydney to be a part of as a performer.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I haven't done some theatre in a long time and it's kind of exciting and scary at the same time. It's one of those things where, although, I pretty much, that's my acting career started on the stage in that sense. When you haven't done something for a little while, you kind of go, is theatre, am I going to be okay?
I absolutely know how you feel.
And it's funny, those thoughts, isn't it? That, I'm chatting to the producer and I'm like, I'm thinking about the audition and I'm going in for the audition. I'm thinking, how's it going to be? Am I going to do all right? It's funny, these thoughts. And it's like, I shouldn't have those thoughts, if that makes sense, but they still...
Yeah, I completely agree. It's all storytelling, so you shouldn't feel that way, but it does really feel like a different muscle. It's like when I was talking about the theatre auditions that I had in the last couple of months and going and being like, oh, right, okay, now how do I do this again? Is this something I'm good at? Can
Correct.
I? Yeah.
Which right is there with a silly you. Thought, right?
Well, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. So really excited about that for this month. The other thing is I want to get back into is investing in my art and in myself. So one of my rules with my storytelling and my acting is that any money I generally make from acting, I try to invest back into training or whatever it might be. And I've noticed recently that I've kind of stepped back from that a little bit. So I just want to get back to investing in myself, going to the classes, making the effort to improve myself over this next month and onwards. Yeah. But really getting back into this idea that, because I really loved it, was like if I got a check from whatever I did, I would go, rightio, that's going to go to acting lessons or that's going to go to voice classes or whatever. And so I just want to get back into that habit. So that's this month I'm going to try and do that. Going back to Sydney Screen Actors Group.
That just reminded me. I was going to say, how's that going?
Really cool. I'm enjoying it. It's a different discipline once again. It's a lot quicker. So, you know, you get the scene. I've spoken about this, but you get the scene literally a couple of days before and you go and do the scene. And once again, I've done so many classes where you might spend 8 weeks on one scene, you know. It's really lovely to be just getting scenes up
Turning
and doing them. And yeah, and trusting that, you know, if you do the work once you get up there, even though you've only had a couple of days to prepare, you're going to be okay. And once again, it's much more like the audition process. As you probably know with all your auditions recently.
Well, when my career was starting off a couple of weeks ago.
So that's my month, Lauren. So, exciting stuff. Really hope the theatre project comes to life and looking forward to getting to a few more classes. What about you? How's your month?
Well, it's a pretty exciting month ahead for me. I'm off to Bali in a couple of weeks' time.
I'm excited for you. That's going to be great, isn't it?
Yeah. It's nice that, as I said, this is my fourth year. We're in the middle of the year. I've gone off to do this work. So it's become that thing of, oh, of course, that's what I do in the middle of the year. I'm going to go and work on my acting really solidly for a period of time where nothing else is interfering with that.
What a luxury.
Channeling storytelling. So that is super exciting. And the next time we chat on air, I'll probably be somewhere in Bali. So
cool.
Just getting that.
And I'll be just jealous.
Of course, I just want to mention something for people who've listened to previous podcasts. I just wanted to let everyone know that we have heard back from the Cannes Film Festival regarding submission of our short film In Life Today. And unfortunately, we didn't make it into the festival. But it was really interesting when I got that email. Obviously, one of the goals was to get into the festival. Yeah. So that didn't happen. But I'm still really excited and it was really nice to find that excitement didn't waver because, of course, the Cannes deadline was the thing that got the film made in the first place.
Yes.
So that's very exciting. Of course, we are submitting for other festivals, so I hope to have good news for you all soon.
I think the thing with that too is that although it didn't get into the festival, one of the beautiful things that I think I've spoken about on this podcast before is the days that we were filming and getting into the house and people buzzing around and just going, look what you've created. So it's one of those things that you're a winner from day one in regards to pulling together everyone to work towards a common goal.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
There's so much uncertainty along the way. You don't necessarily always feel that, but it's nice to come out the other side and be like, yeah, we did that. Exactly. So very good stuff. And I guess that leads really nicely into my continuing focus is this idea of living intentionally. Mm-hmm. And even just saying that makes me really excited. So looking forward to doing that and sharing anything that comes from it on the podcast and with you. And so that probably is a wrap for podcast 24. Thank you all again so much for joining us. We will speak to you in a month. And until that time, you can find us on the usual channels.
The website, About Me, Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, iTunes, everywhere.
Feel free to post on the blog and on Facebook and let us know what you're thinking and feeling and what you'd like to hear from us.
Yeah, and continue, as always, to join us next month on the Act of Storytelling.
Thanks for listening.